Thank you so much for joining our show this evening. We have a wonderful special guest who I'm really excited to speak with this evening. His name is Dr. Fred Alan Wolf, a world-renowned physicist, and he's also known as Captain Quantum. He is the author of 11 books. Thank you so much for that. Just alone, it's helping the world. And the books are Taking the Quantum Leap, Parallel Universes, The Eagle's Quest, The Spiritual Universe, Mind into Matter, Matter into Feeling, The Yoga of Time Travel, which is especially interesting to me, How the Mind Can Defeat Time, also very interesting books, and his latest book, Dr. Quantum's Little Book of Big Ideas. Dr. Fred Alan Wolf is a lecturer, a researcher, and teacher for the worldwide community. He teaches throughout the world and was one of the physicists featured in the hit movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? And he can be reached through his website, www.fredalanwolf.com. Thank you so much for joining our show. I know you have an extremely busy schedule, so I really appreciate you coming on and just sharing your information with us. And also, I just want to say that I'm just so thankful that you have followed your path, which has led to all this immense, enormous research from your soul and through your thoughts and through you, who you are, that you've offered the world and that you are helping the world in this manner. So I just so appreciate who you are. And also Don, our producer, Don Newsom, thank you so much for allowing us to have this show. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Now, I am very interested in how you have developed your own processes of thinking throughout your views as a scientist to where you are now. And one of the reasons why I was thinking about this is because it seems to me, and I'm not quite sure exactly how it has developed your psychological, your spiritual processes, but it seems to me that at some point there had to be more of a turning point for you as a scientist to delve into more of a shamanic a journey or a search in terms of the mysticism or the mystic world and what that all is. And is there a paramount view that is arising for you? These are just some of my questions, so we'll sort these out later. And how is it affecting the way the scientific community is starting to look at what goes on a soul level? And how are you growing in that community? So there seems to me, with all of your extensive experience, and what you're bringing forth from your own connection to your soul and the connection to source, that there's got to be this echoing back and forth in terms of what you're giving to the community and what you're receiving back, and how that is, how you are developing from that process and just your own processes as well.
Okay, well, I don't know where to begin here. Is there a question in there? where should I start? I mean, do you want to ask me something, or do you want me to just talk about myself? I'm not sure what you're asking.
Just talk about the processes that you have developed from a scientific point of view to where you are now and how you see yourself. Is there a point of view that you have arrived at that has brought you from a more scientific point of view to a more mystic point of view?
Actually not. There isn't really any particular point of view. I think I've always taken the point of view that I've taken. And that viewpoint has been, I would say, a consuming curiosity. I'm just interested in stuff. And it naturally led me into physics, because physics is one of the most compelling methods of studying the universe. And so anybody who studies physics at the deepest level and doesn't come away with a sense of mysticism isn't really studying physics. It's impossible to not come away with a sense of awe and mystery and fun and curiosity from studying it. It's one of the most remarkable ways of thinking that we've ever developed. It's far more intricate and interesting than psychic phenomena or spirituality, but it leads one to investigate with a different understanding both psychic phenomena and spirituality.
So there was never any kind of resistance in terms of your own thinking or...
There's always resistance. In fact, if there isn't resistance, then there wouldn't be any memory or any way in which you would understand something. People often miss the point that if you're not resisting new information that's coming into, then you're not really dealing with new information. You're putting it into the category of old information, and you think, quote unquote, that you understand it. The whole idea is to not be in the level, not be at the point where you say, I understand everything. People that understand everything don't understand anything. The way to understand is to not understand. In other words, you have to work through this. You have to actually spend time with it. You've got to think about what's being taught to you. You have to work with the examples. You have to go into the nitty gritty details. In other words, it ain't easy, Mickey. You have to really work. And when you work at stuff, you really do start to develop a sense of awe and mystery, and it becomes more fun. Now, there is, of course, just like anything, when you learn physics or learn to think correctly, what happens to you is that you can develop a kind of a warped sense of view, and I think maybe that's where your question might have been heading, where you begin to believe that the logical rational is the only way of proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to... cut you off from your experiential self, and that's one of the shortcomings that comes from anything that you do. When you become an expert at some things, you become a complete dunce at everything else. So the whole idea is to keep learning and doing things, but don't cut yourself off from the world which is outside of your way of looking at things. And that's my teaching. That's what I teach whenever I do a course or do a workshop. I try to explain people that if you think you don't understand physics, then you really don't understand physics, not because you can't understand physics, because you've chosen not to understand things, because you've chosen to put yourself in the category of being a dunce at physics. And unfortunately, most people do that because the first time they come to any resistance, they don't work through it. And if they would work through it, they would find that the world of physics would open up for them. But if you don't, and you keep holding back, then you end up being thinking less of yourself and listening to others who supposedly know more than you. And then you would go into the idolatry phase of thinking everybody else is smarter than you. And then you become a victim. And,
and it's better, it's better, it's better. Then you need analysis.
Yeah. And the other side of that is that you begin to, if you start to think, well, I've had these psychic experiences, I now, you know, God spoke to me, or I saw a flying saucer, or I spoke with my dad, or I see into the future, and you start thinking you're so wonderful that you can do that, then you start walking around with a totally overblown ego about that.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to think that anybody that doesn't see what you see must either be, you know, undeveloped or stupid, or you know, just well, they're just scientists, they should think differently about it. If they were only a little more psychic, they wouldn't think like that. You know, and that's as dangerously and as stupid thinking as people who go the other way. So the whole point is to keep yourself well developed, where none of us, there's only a human being alive that mm-hmm. is incapable of being absolutely, totally psychic. I mean, experience the whole universe if you want, and being as smart as the most smartest genius you can think of, Einstein, Stephen Hawking, I don't care, you name it, you are capable of doing any of that. It just takes work. And if you're willing to work at it, you can do it. It doesn't mean that you're cut off from doing it. Doesn't mean that you're born dumb in certain ways or you're born without that ability. All that's stopping you is the thought that you can't do it.
That is an awesome statement, and I really appreciate especially what you just said, because one of the things as a trans channel that I got from my dreams, and God bless the dreams that come to all of us, is that for me as a channel, there were two aspects of myself in this particular dream. One was a channel that was arrogant, and one was a channel that was wishy-washy, and none of those approaches can really work or contain what we know as our own natural abilities. So for me to be a channel, I had to be over here in this spot, being a 3-year-old jumping up and down on this drum, because that's what works for me. And those other places actually defend against what we have or resist in a way that don't help, I think what you're trying to say, to contain the new information that comes in that we could really connect with who we are. Because I think it's all our natural ability. Is that what you're saying? Is that we have this ability to really go into our own knowing and know quantum physics from that position, and also from the position that we can have in our own experience and gaining or gleaming the knowledge that we can glean from our own experience. And that's what's going to forward us in our development.
Well, yeah, that's your way of saying it, sure.
So it's very interesting. Now, from what I'm also gathering from what you're saying is that quantum physics, all this psychic phenomena and everything else that happens in our world actually flows from that particular structure. Can you talk about
I'm not sure what you mean by that. What particular structure?
From quantum physics.
What flows from quantum physics? I don't think you have followed your thought. You said
okay,
quantum physics flows from quantum physics?
That psychic experiences and other kind of spiritual experiences and what happens in our lives in terms of what we can experience to happen from our connection with soul or spirit is not something that is unusual, because quantum physics actually contains all of those experiences?
No, quantum physics doesn't contain all those experiences.
Okay.
I don't know what led you to think that. Maybe
no, I'm trying to figure out what you said earlier about how you said
all I said is that every human being has the ability mm-hmm. to be psychic or to be scientific. That's basically what I just said, and that ability is inborn. It's part of human nature, or whatever you want to call it. And whether you want to look at it from the point of view of quantum physics, look at learning or understanding things from quantum physics or any kind of physics, that's something you can do. It's within your realm of being. And if you want to develop your psychic powers and whatever those are, you can do that too. And that there's nobody who's just there's nothing preventing you from developing either or both.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm saying. I don't know what the quantum physics is part of the conversation, but it's not necessarily sourced anything.
Okay.
It's just a way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum physics is just a way of thinking. It's a mathematical, highly disciplined science. It's highly theoretic, and it has many concepts in it, which can act as metaphors for a lot of experiences. There's a tendency amongst people when they first hear the words quantum physics or see it in the movie like What the Bleep,
mm-hmm.
to assume that it's suddenly it's the cat's new pajamas. We just got to have a pair. And everybody starts dressing everything they know in terms of quantum physics. And that really isn't what quantum physics is all about at all. It's just a way of thinking. It's important. And I think when people learn some of the ideas about what quantum physics say, it can help metaphorize your life, because the way we speak, how we talk to each other, the words we use, how we think, are basically forms that we have adopted based on metaphor. We've had an human experience, whatever that experience is, and that experience tells us what that word means. as children. We've hopefully been born in a loving way, and we've been nurtured and mothered and held and warmed, and we have some idea that when somebody says I love you, that it means being mothered and loved and held and nurtured, and that's what love means to us. So when we say I love you, or you say something to a person, I love you, what you're saying to them is I am here to be your nurturer, to provide warmth for you, to provide emotional sustenance, to be there. I mean, I'm here to mother you or father you and take care of you. And when somebody says I love you, we feel that. All words we use are based upon human experience, and quantum physics is just another set of language, a new language that you can learn that for some people who've never had some of the experiences, it may open up their eyes to seeing the world from these new experiences. That's another thing a language can do. Somebody says, I love you, and I've never had the experience of love, we make it curious about what that word means, and as a result, we might start looking to see how other people use it, and then we see, well, that guy said that he loves her, and I noticed that he's hugging her and kissing her. Maybe love has to do with hugging and kissing. So maybe if I learn to do that, then I'll become a better lover, and that leads to a form of love which can go anywhere from being a Casanova to being a rapist. So you see, it's the way we use words and how we associate experience with those words. That's what human beings do. We're very talented, very creative in the way we do that.
Mm-hmm. So what is your hope through your work that people will use this language, that people will begin to experience another type of experience?
You know, I don't have hope for anybody else. All I do is do what I do. I don't hope for the world or hope for this or hope for that. Hope doesn't, to me, it's an empty thing to hope for things. What I do is I do what I do, and mm-hmm. I teach and I explain because that's what I do. Would you ask a tree to hope for its leaves? You could, I suppose, but the tree will say, I leave. That's what I do. I don't hope for leaves. I make leaves because I am a tree. And I'm what I am. So I do what I do. It's part of my way of being. I've stopped hoping for people to do things or get things or whatever. I just put things out there, and I'll help people if they're willing to help themselves. I'll help them understand things, but I don't hope that they will or wish that they will. It's really up to them. We've been given the gift of individuality. It's a wonderful gift, and it's something that I never impose my hopes or wishes on another human being. So I don't hope. I don't use that word.
Okay, well, we'll rescind that word now that I
understand. That's all right. I'm just saying it doesn't have any much. It doesn't have much meaning for me. People use it, but mm-hmm. it sounds like, well, do you pray for this or do you wish for this? As if my wishes and my prayers are going to make any huge difference, and some people believe they do. So maybe that's why they use that language.
So, where are you in terms of your work right now, in terms of all that you've come to be? And it looks like through your books, one of your latest books, you're starting to explore time.
Well, actually, the Yoga of Time Travel, that's already 2 years old now. I mean, I wrote it 2 years ago and it came out last year, so it's already past work.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really exploring that particular aspect of physics right now. But if you're asking me what I'm currently working on,
yes, please.
That's a whole other story. There are a couple of projects that I have going, and they vary and they are somewhat alike. One problem that's got me perplexed, one that I'm very interested in, and it's a consuming question, is granted that we are all of one mind or one spirit or God or however you want to say it, if we're all of the one, if one is where we're from, then why is there so much individuality and so much, you know, problems in the world posed by the individuality which arises. How does individual mind seem to arise from the one mind which we seem to be?
Mm-hmm.
And that question is very perplexing. It's not perplexing if you just assume that mind is somehow, and this is the general way it's looked at, if mind is something that arises out of matter, like Frankenstein monsters have minds which arise from electrical sparks, translated across dead meat, then that's not a problem. That's not a problem. But if you study quantum physics enough and you begin to understand more about what it's meant and what it's telling us about the nature of the observer and how observation is part of what is observed, is not just out there, but is somewhat, in some cases, drastically affected by how you go about looking at it,
mm-hmm.
And that there is no out there independent of the experience, then you begin to wonder, well, who's the experiencer? Where is the idea of their reality coming from? And why do I have this idea that I am the creator of it? Am I the creator of all of reality? If I am, Jesus, then who am I?
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not, well, then why not? Why can't I do these things? Why can't I just fly off the ground? Why am I not able to leap tall buildings in a single bound? Why am I not Superman? Or why am I not able to go back into time with just my mind and just go flying through the time zones and do all the things that we see in the movies? And why can't, you know, if I'm superpower, why can't I do that? So these are the questions that naturally arise when one begins to wonder, if there is only one mind and I'm tuned to it, why am I not super powerful? Why do I have the experience that you have a separate mind from mine? I mean, I'm talking to you, and I'm even though I have a sense that there's only one mind here, why is it that I don't engage with other people as if there was only one mind going on? I engage with other people as if everybody's separate, and I walk around labeling things, saying, oh, you're this, and I'm that, and this is this, and I'm that, and so forth. So I'm interested in that question. And so I'm exploring the way to answer that question through some understandings of quantum physics, particularly making models of what it means to observe things. So these models lead to some very interesting questions, and I'm currently working on that.
Well, that sounds really interesting. That was one of my questions when I was reading What the Bleep book, because they were talking about people observing a truck. And of course, everybody's seeing the truck, and why can't we shapeshift the truck into something different, like a bird perhaps? And why is it that we don't have that kind of creative power if we are all tuned into one another somehow? And to what extent does our consciousness or the way that we observe things affect somebody else's observation of the same thing? Like, where do they meld? And how does it end, and how does it stop?
Well, those are the big questions. And the answer, there's certain things we can answer based upon an understanding of what we do understand about quantum physics and the observer. When we're talking about very large objects like trucks, or for that matter, when you have peas and carrots, one single pea, or a dust mote, which is that fine little fuzzy thing you see floating in the air when sunlight comes through a Venetian blind into your darkened room. Those things are, on the level of quantum physics, massive objects. They're very huge.
Mm-hmm.
And they behave what we call in a classical manner. That is, they behave as if quantum physics has nothing to do with anything. They behave as if they have their own existence independent of anything your mind can do with them. And that seems to be true. What we're talking about here is the very nature of quantum physics. Quantum physics, some people get the idea that everything is just out there and the mind picks it, you go into a grocery store and everything's out there like a cluster of grapes, and you just pick one grape, and that's reality. And all the other clusters just remain back there, but you can always go just pick one, pick one, pick one. It's, they think you're just picking reality like that. It doesn't quite work that way. There are some rules to the game as to how that picking goes on. It isn't just a matter of just picking a grape, but there's a whole set of things that go on. And one of the things that goes on has to do with something called inertia or resistance or mass, how much mass or resistance or inertia the object has, or objects have. And depending on how massive they are, the effect of the observer on those objects gets less and less. There's always an effect, but it's so small that you can't, it's immeasurable. It's just too tiny to even be seen. So you're not going to bounce a large truck around with your mind. You're not going to bounce even the pea on your plate with your mind. It's very, very difficult to do. At decimal level, you're beginning to get to a point where the mind could possibly jiggle a dust mote around, but when you get down to the molecules of your own nervous system, that's when there seems to be some effect that mind can have on the objects which make up your nervous system. So it's very possible and seems likely, according to many models that are being made right now, that the brain may be operating in a kind of quantum mechanical way. And just how that all works is something which is still being researched.
Now, one of the things that that crossed my mind as you were talking, do these objects such as trucks or a pea or anything else out there, a grape in the grocery store, do they have their own energy or life force that would be independent somehow?
Everything has energy.
Right.
That is, if it exists, it has energy. If it's in space and time, and it has matter, then it has energy, because matter and energy are the same thing. Now, life force can mean many things. It depends on who you're speaking to. For some, life force and energy are the same thing. For others, life force is something which pertains to what is called biological forms, like plants and animals. Then we would say there's life force in plants and animals. We wouldn't say necessarily that there's life force in rocks and trees, but if you begin to look at things from a different point of view, you may begin to say that there's life force in everything. And this mysterious life force may have something to do with the quantum nature of everything. And that's something I tend to think makes some sense to me, that everything has a form of what I call life force or consciousness. And the difference between a rock's consciousness and mind is that the rock is interested in the things that I'm interested in.
Right.
And so it's been around a long time. A rock is a piece of something which has existed for millions of years. And because it's been around for millions of years, it's probably not too interested in the time scale upon which I do all the things of the activities of my life. It's on a whole different time scale. And if I could see its life on the time scale of the whole millions of years, I might very well see how conscious and alive it really is. And this is a thought which arises in many cultures, including the Native American and Aboriginal cultures. They feel that Great Spirit is in everything. And that they look at things that way, and they have a sense of the magnitude of the time scale upon which these things operate.
So, well, one of the ideas that's coming across my mind is that if everything has a consciousness, and it sounds like it's embedded in a time and dimension or space that we're not necessarily familiar with or can completely understand, in which...
Well, it's not that mysterious. Let me see if I can explain it to you in a much simpler way. It's a question of the scale of time. A redwood tree is a living thing, but if you walk out and look at it in California, other than the wind that rustles its leaves from time to time, it just stays there. It doesn't seem to be moving at all. But if you look at over a 100-year span of its life, you see that it's very much moving and very much so it's operating on a different time scale.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to ignore things which move slowly or not see things which move quickly. And that's really all that's involved here. It's nothing mysterious. It's not like in some other dimension or thing. You know, we don't have to go ooh, woo, woo, woo about it. It's just simply a question of scale of time.
Huh. But that leads me into the point of my question. Is there a way to communicate then?
Well, it
in
depends on what
way?
You mean by what. First of all, what does it mean to communicate with anything?
Well, I don't know, but you know,
well, that's the question. You see, yes, you can communicate with nature. You can communicate with a tree.
Mm-hmm.
You can communicate with the whole universe. But what does it? What would it mean to you to have such a communication? For some people, it means they hear a voice talking to them and saying, "Don't do this, do that." Well, that's fine, but that may not be how a redwood tree would care to communicate with you. After all, you want to communicate with it. Well, maybe you ought to listen to what it's telling you.
Right.
And it may not be telling you the same kind of things you're asking. So what does it mean to communicate? So people, you know, it can mean different things for people. And some people get really nutty about it, and they start thinking that just because they're having these thoughts that somehow God is talking to them or this great spirit is talking to them. It may be just them egoistically talking to themselves. And that's why, you know, it depends on what kind of questions you're asking. What time? That's why science is important. It gives you a sense of time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're asking about, you know, what would God say to me? Well, on the time scale of God, I mean, you're less than a flea bite. I mean, you're just nothing. There's so little that's going on that time scale. So what would you expect God to say to you? What you can say to God may be a different thing, but, you know, it's just a whole different game. This doesn't mean that you can't have an experience of your spirit or God-like thing or the vastness of it all. And I think that kind of awe and living in the mystery is what really gives you that greater sense of communication. And that's why I tell people, even in the movie, I say live in the mystery, not in the know. That's one way you can experience this great communication.
Yeah, I think that part of my question was, is that if we could communicate with a truck, for example, that there would be some way of changing it if it was interested. But from what you're saying is that everything has an independent consciousness that just is in the be. Like you started the conversation earlier about you're just being and you no longer necessarily have hope for anybody else to follow or accept help or whatever. You're just there. You're presenting an opportunity. And I'm just wondering about if there is a way that if there was an openness or a way of communicating with the energy in inanimate objects, if we got to that point where
let's take that to a logical conclusion.
Let's
assume that everybody can do just what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
That every human being on this planet right now is capable of communicating with every single object in the whole universe.
Mm.
How would things change? The answer is they'd be exactly the same as they are right now. Now, let that sink in for a while. Why? Why would they be the same? Well, you're standing, let's give you a simple example. You're standing at a street corner and the light is red, but you want to get across and you don't want to wait till the light turns green because you want to get across now. This is your time. I want to get across now. So you go, ooga, 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 and the light suddenly flips and it becomes green. There you go. And say, I did it. I did it. I did it. Meanwhile, across the street on the other side, trying to cross the other way, is somebody is just about to see the light's green, is crossing and feels really, oh, my God, I created the green. I got here just now and the green is there. I did it. Yeah, I'm going to cross now. And then, but suddenly the other guy says, I want green. No, I want green. No, I want green. And there is this battle and the pure light says, which way should I go? Which way should I go? Which one wants it? Which one? And we have what is called the universe. And that's what's going on right now. Everybody wishing and demanding and egoically asking for their own desires, and that's what you get. You get this noise of creation right now. People just calm down and relax and just simply enjoy the spiritual presence that they're in and realize that their life is going to be over in a flea bite of time, and just simply enjoy the experience and do what you can do. Surf the quantum wave, if you will. I use that metaphor. Don't try to control it. Just surf it. Find out which direction it's going in and ride it rather than letting it drown you.
Going with the flow.
That's what going with flow means. It doesn't mean directing traffic. It means going with the flow. It means seeing what's going on. It doesn't mean you can't alter your own course in it and do things. That's why you have a human body. You can do things. But the old adage, do unto others, you would have them do unto you. If you want a green light, you better watch out for the guy whose red light is going to be changed.
In your experiments now, how...
I don't do experiments.
Oh, I'm sorry. In your research now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. How do you define the observer, or what is the observer?
Well, that's the question. That's the very question I'm researching, is how do you... That's the very question I'm asking, and I don't have an answer.
Okay, because what I'm asking is, how do you go about that? If it's something that
I can explain what I'm doing, but I can't explain... I can't give you a simple answer to the question.
Mm-hmm.
We make a model. And what we do, a theoretical model. I use mathematics, for example. And I'm trying to look at, what is the nature of observation? And it seems that all observation stems from one very basic thing, that there has to be individuality of things, an observer and an observed. There has to be at least that duality. So we have to start from there, even though fundamentally we're trying to get to unity, we start from there being separate. And that one thing is acting as observer and the other is acting as observed. It doesn't matter which one is which, but we label things this way. So we start off by making labels because we understand the world that way. And then we say, what's the nature of observation? And it starts with, we two have to interact in some way. There has to be something called an interaction. They have to bump into each other, or they have to, and as a result of the interaction, something has to change. If they interact but nothing changes, well, then there hasn't been any observation. So something has to change. And what we assume goes on is that the thing which changes of those two objects which interact, that's the thing which is called the observer. The thing which changes. The other one doesn't change, and that's called the observed. So whenever there's an observer and an observed, the thing that changes in the quantum model is called the observer, and the thing which doesn't change is called the observed. And now we have to look at the consequences of that sort of activity, and that's essentially what I'm doing, is working out a model of that so we can understand it. Now, two people can observe each other and both can change, but that's just that adds a complication. That makes the mathematics more difficult. It seems to me that one starts off by something as simple as one can make it, tries to understand that before one gets into more complicated arrangements, like what happens when two observers meet.
One of the things that I was thinking about is the means of observing always the same, or does that change?
It changes. It depends on first of all, if you start off with the notion that anything which is observed involves the senses, then you have to say which senses.
Right. That's what I was getting to.
So,
because are they always external senses, or are they?
Well, I don't know what
you
mean by external senses. We all have senses.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on your culture and how you're trained, you have anywhere from 5 to 10. As far as I understand it, some Native American tribal people deal with what they call the 10 senses. We're normally used to our 5 so-called physical senses. In the literature that was written at the time of Plato, he spoke of basically 6, and also the Buddha spoke of 6. He said the mind is also a sense. So I wouldn't call the mind a sense in the sense that I use it, in the direction that I use it. I would say that the senses we use, the ones I understand, because that's how I grew up, are the common senses that we have, which is we can see, we can hear, we can smell, we can taste, we can touch. They're common five senses that we have. They all really are related to one basic operation in the brain, but nevertheless, those are what we call. Now, some people say they have a psychic sense. They sense what's coming. Well, that's fine. If we can make a measurable model of how that works, then we would have a model for psychic activity. Right now, that seems to be something that many people are working on. But nobody's come up with a definitive model of what that psychic sense is.
Okay. So those types of
your question.
Those type of inward senses are not necessarily the primary observer. In other words,
no, I didn't say that.
What I'm trying to figure out is there a way of doing the research or a model of the research where somebody goes into a meditative stance or trance?
Well, you can always do research in many different ways. Mm-hmm. And what I was speaking about is the research I do, which is basically I'm trained as a physicist, so I think about things in terms of models based upon my understanding of physics. If you were trained in a different way, you can make models differently. A biologist would make biology models. A psychic might have psychic models in which they do this kind of research. But I don't know about those.
Okay. Yeah, because that's what I was just wondering. If there's something that is moving towards more of a meditative or looking at things from a trance state, and if that has an effect on what's being observed at all, or if there is any kind of movement from a different type of model rather than using just the five senses or the eyes.
Well, it's an interesting question. And the question I would put to anybody who's thinking along those lines is, how would you measure it? And how would you determine it? And how could you communicate that to another?
Right.
How would you know their person is really having this experience and isn't fooling themselves.
Right.
So this is where the scientific model becomes very valuable, and that's why I think it's important that everybody, including psychics, learn science, learn what the techniques of science are really all about, because it helps you in your thinking, and it doesn't have to diminish your abilities to see or reason psychically. Just because you have a scientific mind doesn't mean you can't be psychic.
Okay. Now, this is going back a little bit, but I'd like to know about your research into time.
Okay.
Can you share with us some of your findings or some of what your experiences were?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, I wrote a book about it. I've written several books about time, actually. So it's hard for me to just tell you a particular thing, but I'll mention some of the books for your listeners out there.
Absolutely.
The latest book is called The Yoga of Time Travel, and I'll come back to what that title means, or how the subtitle is How the Mind Can Defeat Time. I'll explain what that all means in a moment. The book before that, dealing with time, was called Parallel Universes, which one reviewer said it had amazing speculations about the nature of time travel. And the notion of time travel, first of all, is a very important one. And it wasn't until recently, when I began researching for the book The Yoga of Time Travel, that I became aware that time and the sense of self, or observer or ego, are intimately connected. And that to me was a very powerful insight into the nature of time. So now let me go to the title of The Yoga of Time Travel. First of all, let me deal with the subtitle, How the Mind Can Defeat Time. The original subtitle was going to call How the Mind Can Cheat time. And the word cheating is a very funny word, but it actually comes from Sanskrit. In the ancient Sanskritic literature, the people that practiced yoga said that they were, when they found out what they were doing or when they began to get into it, they saw that was something they experienced as cheating time. They call it kala vankana, and kala meaning it was a Sanskrit word meaning time, and vankana means evading it or cheating it or getting beyond it. In other words, the notion that they had was that time is such a compelling force or idea in the universe that people who go on with their everyday lives have the experience that they're caught in time. They're caught in the web of it. They can't get out of it. Whereas in the yoga experiences, what they were learning is that it was possible to cheat it, that you could get around it. You don't have to follow its dictates. And that was what that was part of the insights that comes from such works as the Bhagavad Gita and the study of yogic systems. And when I found that out, I was kind of surprised, and so I decided, well, let me milk this. Let me see how far I can take this metaphor. And it led into realization that these yogis from way back had begun to see that they could indeed time travel, that they were able to escape the bounds of time, and that that made some sense to me, because when I began studying quantum physics, in fact when I began studying physics at all, one of the things that came up was the notion that time was not absolutely fixed. We learned that no idea from Einstein's theory of relativity, that time was not absolutely fixed. And since it wasn't absolutely fixed, it meant that it wasn't permanent and it didn't flow everywhere at the same time, so to speak. We can't even speak about it metaphorically because we use time as our metaphor to speak about time, which is really kind of talking in a circle. But I don't know, there's no other language we have, so we have to do it. Anyway, that's basically what quantum physics and Einstein and relativity were telling me. So, what I did in the book was to, first of all, explain to everybody just what is Einstein's idea of relativity and why does it say that time is not fixed. And then, I went on to explain, well, how, if it's not fixed, then how would you go about time travel? And then I went through some of the research that has been done over the last 20 years or so by physicists published in respectable journals on building time machines. And I thought,
cool.
Well, this is very interesting. These
mm-hmm.
guys are serious. This is not just a wishful thinking anymore. And that's what I wrote about in the book, trying to explain that to people in a simple way as I could.
Well, that's really interesting to me, because I change time all the time. For example, I'll speed up a meeting, and if I have to get someplace to an appointment or something, and people will actually notice it. And if I have to make daycare, I'm always slowing down time. So, and if I have special projects that I want speeded up, I'll speed up the time to make the special projects happen. Is there a way, I guess there isn't really a way to figure out exactly how to escape that in terms of a theory. So it's not something, I know that there's Einstein's theory, but I'm just wondering how the yogis have managed to be able to jump out of time. So then how does the observer see the observed, that the observed is able to do that? Does that make any sense at all?
Well, it does make sense.
Good, thank
but,
you.
But first we have to get through some ideas that you've mm-hmm. expressed, including your own human experiences. There is a, there, there's a lot of different ways to talk about time, and there's a lot of different experiences of time.
Mm-hmm.
There's an age-old time experience, which has to do with the observation of things which appear to apparently repeat themselves, like the sunrise and the sunset, or the yearly journey of the sun's position relative to the horizons of setting and rising suns throughout the year. These are things which have been observed by people and gave them notions of a large scale time. And when you're talking about your own personal experiences and meetings and so forth, we're on a different time scale. It's something I mentioned at the very beginning of this show about how there are different scales of time, and
mm-hmm.
One has to become aware of that. So when you're talking about changing time, you're not changing those large scale times at all, but what
mm-hmm.
you are changing is your experience of time. And your experience of time is for you the time that you spend. Even though it may be an hour spent on everybody else's clock, you may have only spent 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
In that time zone. And you may have only aged 10 minutes in that time zone. You know, everybody else has aged a whole hour. Or for some people, they could have aged 10 years in an hour. And there's many stories of that, too, of people who suddenly get very old and wrinkled in a very short period of time, or their hair turns gray in a matter of days overnight and stuff of that sort. That we've heard many stories of those, too. So anybody can change their temporal experiences, what I say is there, because of that, their relative amount of time that they actually have experiences may be different. There is a relativity to time, in other words. So if other people that you talked about who observed you speeding up or slowing down time, they can also get into your time zone with you. And if they can, they will also have similar experiences. And I've heard many stories of people that are driving in cars and suddenly a trip that should have taken 3 hours only took two. And they wonder what had actually happened. And that both of them seem to have an agreement as to what, if anything, actually occurred. And so there are many, many possibilities here.
Hmm.
And many possible explanations for it all.
Very interesting about people getting into other people's time zones.
Well, we do. We tend to do that. If you can totally get into somebody else's time zone, the way you would do that, and when you do that, what you do is you lose your ego. You lose a sense of your own personal self. And people often have that experience. Many people don't realize it, but you walk into a room where there's a charismatic speaker, and the speaker, you feel almost hypnotized by the person, and you're in love with them, or you feel swept away, or my God, where did the time go? You know, all those kinds of experiences, and those are very typical. Or get caught in a drama in a movie theater. We're watching a film, and we get caught into the film. We're the hero or the heroine, or we're the bad guy, and we get caught into that. So we more easily than people like to admit, lose the sense of ego. The only problem that we have with that is people aren't aware that they do that. If they were more aware that they are escaping their personal time zone boundaries, they would understand that that is essentially a yoga technique. That's what the yogas do.
Hmm. Well,
but there's something else you can surrender to other than a good movie.
Well, thank you so much. I just want to thank you so much for being on the show this evening. You've just been a delight and just full of extremely interesting information, and I just appreciate you and all of your research. And if you want to reach Dr. Fred Alan Wolf, please visit his website at www.fredallenwolf.com. And thank you so much again.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. And have a good evening, folks, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye now.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.